All right, now we'll join the County Board of Commissioners weekly meeting, and Dr. Locke is sitting in for Allison Berry, so here we go.
In Washington State, cases are down by 58%, hospitalization is down 32%, deaths are declining by 8%, and ICU deaths by 44%. We're still seeing on the Olympic Peninsula a lot of Omicron activity, although it's dropping. So Jefferson County is down by 8% in the last 2 weeks. That puts us at about 618 per 100,000 over a 2 week span, cases, daily cases per 100,000, it's 49. Which is actually still a little above the state rate. Clallam County is the area where it's actually gone up just a bit in the last week, or really has plateaued. And the Clallam County rate on the Clallam website is just under 900 cases per 100,000. So we're expecting that to drop still further, and we won't really be at the bottom of this wave until the mid part of March or so. And as we all know, we're entering into kind of a turning point in the pandemic, or at least a shift from this emergency containment mode that we've been in for the last several years into something that we hope is more sustainable and less disruptive. And this is going to be a very challenging transition. We're seeing it, first of all, in the various restrictions that, as many of us know, last week the governor announced that the statewide masking requirements will be removed as of March 21st. Dr. Berry has announced that she will be rescinding the order requiring proof of vaccination for restaurants and bars as of March 11th. So those are both in the works. Masking will continue to be required in healthcare settings and on public transit. And I'm not seeing those mandates going away anytime in the near future. And we're also changing the focus on case investigations at both a state and a local level. In the past, we really tried to do as close to 100% case investigations, isolation, quarantine as possible. But during the Omicron wave, this just became impossible. So Clallam and Jefferson, I think, moved away from this over a month ago, really have been focusing on outbreaks and high priority populations. And the state is following suit and now is officially doing exactly the same thing. And it's unlikely that we'll ever go back to what we were doing in the first year or two of the pandemic. As this goes from pandemic to endemic, it really means accepting this as a way of life. We always will have some COVID around, at least for the next several years, and it'll occur in waves. And really how it behaves will have a lot more to do with the virus than anything else. That as we look to the future, not only are new variations or variants possible, they're really to be expected. If we've learned anything from this last two waves, it's to expect the unexpected. Is Delta was a real surprise in many ways, in that it was not only more contagious but also more virulent. And Omicron was a real curveball. It just came out of nowhere and was dramatically mutated from its original forms, and had a significant amount of what's known as immune escape. So prior infection or prior vaccination did not fully protect you against Omicron. And these will likely be the patterns of the future. In fact, in the KPTZ questions, I'll be talking about the newest variant we're looking at, the BA2. I'll talk about what we know about that so far. So this is really the shape of things to come. we're in the active planning phases for the long-term pandemic, and where we really want to use as few restrictions as possible to get economies and schools and everyday life back to normal. But the real challenge is going to be doing this in a way that protects the vulnerable. So the aged, the immunosuppressed, children under 5 who are not eligible for vaccination, and the unvaccinated. All of these groups are still at risk for very serious complications, and our public health strategies have to be designed to try to protect them. So as usual, there's some great questions from KPTZ listeners, six of them. But first, turn it over to the commissioners.
Any questions for Dr. Locke?
I have a couple questions, but since Commissioner Dean has to leave in a little bit, I'll defer if you have anything you'd like to ask Kate.
Oh, thanks. That's okay. And Dr. Locke and Willie, you'll see me drop off. I have to go do a quick testimony, but hopefully I'll be back before you leave us.
Well, I have two questions, both with far-reaching implications, one very specific and one very general. And just from your talk, Dr. Locke, I mean, COVID now, correct me if I'm wrong, is basically Omicron. Delta has been outpaced. I mean, I guess one question, is Delta out there still somewhere? Or I guess do we have to look backwards as well in dealing with COVID is my question.
In the US and specifically in Washington State, where we have very good data, Delta has virtually disappeared. Very, less than 1% of cases sequence as Delta. And that's really the only good news about Omicron, is it completely displaced Delta. So, and another way of looking at that is that infection with Omicron is highly protective against Delta. So it outcompeted it. And it's yet to be seen if now the BA2 strain can somehow outcompete Omicron. We're hoping that won't happen, but it's always a possibility. The virus that is most transmissible and also is best at evading prior immunity, it's the one that's going to get naturally selected out.
Gotcha. Okay. Very interesting. And then a very specific question. I've heard in the schools now, I'll just throw it out there explicitly, my daughter would love to hang out with a friend whose sibling tested positive, is vaccinated and boosted, but asymptomatic. And the school is now talking about perhaps modified quarantine for this child, since even 5 days after exposure and a positive test, still getting a positive test, but still asymptomatic. The kid, the sibling has gone back to school. My question is, an asymptomatic but very, repeated positive test in a juvenile, reason to quarantine the whole household, from other people visiting, since no one else is tested positive, no one has demonstrated any symptoms. What's safe? I guess it just feels like the landscape is really shifting under us with lots of infections, but not a lot of symptoms, especially in school age kids. And I'm concerned about the permutations branching.
Yeah. Well, and this is one of the big challenges of Omicron, where there's a very high asymptomatic rate. There was one study that suggested maybe as high as 80% of Omicron cases are without symptoms. And this is especially true in people who have either been vaccinated or had prior infection. So I think in those situations, you really want to go by the test result. Unfortunately, the data we have about asymptomatic infection is that the viral levels are high. They can be as high as with people who are symptomatic, and therefore they can be as infectious. So I would regard a persistent positive test as a sign that the person is still shedding the virus. And you want to wait until the the test is negative before you can really sound the all clear. And then in terms of quarantine, it really has to do with exposure risk. So people who are close contacts of that person with the positive case should treat themselves as close contacts. And sort of what they do in terms of quarantine or not quarantine depends a lot on their vaccination status. So if they have up-to-date vaccination, so primary series plus a booster, they don't really have to quarantine, but they need to be mindful of symptoms and ideally should be tested at 5 days or so after their last exposure. But this whole thing, it's going to be fluid. You know, as we deal with new variants, as we learn more, we'll be trying different strategies and try to find that balance point between what is least restrictive, but still highly protective. And allows schools to stay in session and as many students to participate as possible. That's really the goal at this point.
Great. And then my final question, I promise, is you know, we're reaching a new landscape here with the, you know, the vaccine and requirement in restaurants, indoor seating, as well as the mask requirement. And I guess I was just hoping that you could reassure people that the old mantra of I wear my mask for you and you wear yours for me is not quite what we're dealing with now. And that if you are still concerned, a good KN95 or N95 mask, even a surgical mask, will still continue to convey protection. And that, you know, the same way we shouldn't judge that those that we disagree with. I feel like a lot of people are still going to be wearing masks and that those will still be protective when they're going out in the public.
Now, that's a very important point. In fact, that was the gist of the first KPTZ question and first asking that notion that my mask protects you, your mask protects me. Is that still true? And it is from a source control standpoint. So when you look at masks, you're really looking at two main variables. How good the mask is in trapping any virus that an infected person might be shedding. That's what we call source control. And then how good is it for personal protection? How good is it at preventing us from inhaling a virus that may be floating in the air? And those are really two different things. And just about any mask, any facial covering, has a significant benefit with source control. But in terms of personal protection, there's a lot of variation. You know, simple one or two ply cloth masks don't offer a lot of personal protection at all. Even a poorly fitting surgical type mask is not that good. What's really good are these high efficiency masks, which are now plentiful. And in fact, the government is distributing for free. So N95, which is the medical standard, KN95, which if you have a non-counterfeit mask, is a very good choice. And then the KF94 from Korea, which are designed to not touch your face. So they don't touch your nose or your mouth and therefore are somewhat more comfortable. These are the predominant masks out there. And if they're worn properly, if you have a good fit, they are highly protective against breathing in airborne particles. And that's really going to be the new strategy for people who want to reduce their risks. And it's good to think back and, you know, that this was early in the pandemic. We talked about the three C's of confined spaces and crowded places and close contact. These are the kind of situations where you're in public with a bunch of strangers that you want to be wearing these high efficiency masks. If you're in a confined space, especially one that's poorly ventilated or where a lot of people are crowded together, that's where the risk is going to be. And the risk is still going to be there even when the mask mandates disappear, because the virus has not completely disappeared. So it's going to be necessary for people to protect themselves. And one other thing I'd say about that is that prevalence, you know, what we call prevalence, that is how much infection is around there, and also dose, how much virus you're exposed to, is very important in terms of whether you get infected or not. So if you're being exposed 100 times a day, that is really different than once a day or once a week. The lower you can reduce your occurrence of exposure, the less likely you're going to be to get infected. And then also the amount of virus that you're exposed to seems to make a big difference, not only as to whether you get infected or not, but how severely ill you become. And that's where masks become really important, because if they can reduce exposure down to very low levels of the virus, it's unlikely that people will get infected. And so that's what we're going for in the future, is to reduce exposure risk. We can't prevent it 100%, but we can substantially reduce it.
Sorry, I do have a follow-up, and that's just, I see there's all sorts of different facial hair configurations on this screen. Mark had a goatee, Willie's got the full frontier here. Can Willie wear a mask and protect himself? Can I, without going to more of a goatee style?
No, you won't get the full benefit of a respirator type mask unless you have a really tight facial seal. So if you were healthcare workers and you were trying to pass a fit test for an N95 mask, you wouldn't pass. However, you still get substantial benefit. And a lot of it, you can tell when you put the mask on. When you breathe in and you notice the mask deforming, you've got a pretty good seal. But the bottom line is your beard is not as good a filter as the mask material.
Thank you. I'm done. I promise.
Okay.
Hey. I will defer the time to the KPTZ questions, Dr. Locke.
Okay, great. Well, I already tackled number one, which was about masks. So number two is about the BA2, the Omicron variant. And there's actually three subvariants of Omicron that have been identified. And BA2 is the most worrisome of them. It is so different from Omicron that it's probably going to get its own Greek alphabet name in the near future. And it's one that currently about 4% of virus isolates in the US are testing out as BA2. In the Northwest, it's a little higher. In the week that concluded February 19th, it was at 4.6%. And one thing that was concerning is that was almost double what it was a week before. So it went from 2.5 to 4.6%. And it's whether it continues to go up depends a lot on how good it is at avoiding the immunity that's been induced by Omicron or by the vaccines. We have some data from countries where it's much more prevalent. So in UK, in Denmark, where almost all the cases are BA2, and South Africa. And even though we're seeing it spread in those countries, we're not seeing more severe disease as measured by hospitalization or death rates. But that's very early information. And it's something that really bears watching very carefully, because the Japanese study that just came out a couple days ago, it's mostly a lab-based study looking at tissue culture and animal models, but it shows some concerning trends that this BA2 strain is about 30 to 40% more transmissible than Omicron. And that one of the things that's most concerning actually to me is a very technical issue called fusogenicity. And it has to do with how the virus enters our cells. Is one of the things that made Omicron less severe is that it had a harder time getting into our cells by directly fusing to the membranes. It had to get in through a kind of a backdoor mechanism called an endosome. And that's also responsible for why it appears not to have gotten deep into the lungs, that it could only infect the cells in the upper airways. And now this BA2 variant is moving more back in the direction of Delta and being able to do this process called membrane-to-membrane fusion. So we're concerned about that. But a BA2 wave may not happen. It all depends on population immunity. And we're generating a lot of population immunity at this point in the US. The mix between vaccination and boosters and natural infections and breakthrough infections and asymptomatic infections is making people more and more immune with the passage of time. And that's the main thing we have going for us, is we are becoming, as a people, we are becoming more and more resistant to COVID waves. And it's been that way throughout human history. This is not the first and it won't be the last pandemic. And eventually pandemics do go away. It's just a question of how long it takes to develop that decisive population immunity. But so in summary though, BA2 is not a harmless subvariant, and it's really something that we need to watch carefully. There was a question number three: how good are the antigen tests at detecting the newest variants? And there's conflicting studies about these. Some studies say they're very good. Some studies say they may be less sensitive against these variants than prior variants. But in all cases, it seems to be a matter of sensitivity. That is, how good is the test at picking up the virus at certain levels of virus? So there isn't a problem with what we call specificity. So if the test is positive, it means you've got COVID. It's very unlikely to be a false positive. But the amount of virus that it takes to trigger the test can vary. And that's why these tests are most effective for people who have symptoms or people who have had exposure history, because these are the groups that are most likely to have the virus. And the tests are least effective for people who are asymptomatic and just randomly testing themselves. They're really not that good at completely excluding infection. But they are good at saying whether you are infectious on that given day. Because as a general rule, if you don't have enough virus in your nasal passage to trigger the test, it's unlikely that you're going to spread it to someone else, even if you have low levels in your body. But as the questioner points out, they ask when would you do serial tests? Doing multiple tests is better at ruling out infection. So if you do a test, it's negative, and then you do it again 2 days later, and it's still negative, and especially if you're doing this because you've been exposed, you had a close contact exposure, that's actually very good at ruling out infection. It rivals PCR testing. Rapid tests are not perfect. But they're kind of the best we have, and they're becoming more and more available, and we certainly encourage people to use them. There was a question number four that says, for those who received boosters last fall, are they wearing off? And I wouldn't really call it wearing off, but we do know that the antibody levels that are increased by vaccines, they do decline. And there was just a recent CDC study that said The booster dose vaccine antibody levels are now declining about 4 months after the booster dose. And so a lot of people, the first wave of boosters are starting to get to that point. And with that declining antibody level, your chance of getting an infection, if you're exposed to the virus, starts to go up, because the antibodies are your first line of defense against the virus. But fortunately, the protection from the vaccine or from natural infection is a lot more sophisticated than that. And there's actually a series of really good Science Journal articles on this just in the last couple of weeks that are really unlocking the secrets of COVID immunity. And antibody levels are just the start. What seems to be really crucial are what goes on in these two cell populations. So one are called the B cells. These are the cells that actually make antibodies. And what the studies are showing is that these B cells get better and better at making antibodies, and not just to the original vaccine strain, but also antibodies that are more effective against variants. This process goes on for months after the vaccine. The B cells either go to these areas of the body called germinal centers or to our bone marrow, where they're conferring protection that gets better and better over time. And then a population of white cells called T cells also are doing a similar thing. And what T cells do is they don't directly attack the virus. They attack cells that are infected with the virus. And they seem to be the decisive thing that protects us against severe infection. So the bottom line is that the ability of the vaccines or natural infection to prevent breakthrough infections does diminish over time after a booster dose, but fortunately, the ability to prevent against severe disease or hospitalization or death, those benefits seem to be preserved. And for that reason, currently the CDC and the FDA are not recommending routine boosters. So there's not a current plan to reboost people that were boosted back in September and October. There are a few countries that have been experimenting with that. Israel and the UK have been giving booster doses to older populations. We still don't know that for certain, whether there's really a substantial benefit of that. So right now, the only people who are officially recommended to get a fourth vaccine dose are people who have immune suppression problems. And they're really what they get three doses in their primary series and then get a booster to that. So I'd reassure people who have been fully vaccinated that they really do have good protection against serious disease. And if they get a breakthrough infection, that protection gets even better. One of the findings of the studies last week was, as a general rule, vaccine-induced immunity is better than natural immunity in the sense that it's more consistent. People who get really severe COVID generally get a strong immune response to it, but people who get mild COVID generally do not get as consistent of immunity as you do with vaccines. But the best is hybrid immunity. So people who are vaccinated and then get a low-grade infection, they get a very good immune response. People who have had COVID and then get fully vaccinated, they also get a very good immune response. So that's what we're encouraging is it's still vaccine remains the crucial strategy in bringing the pandemic under control. Question five had to do with availability of some of these new antiviral agents, Paxlovid and molnupiravir. And these are very good drugs, especially Paxlovid, that are, they're still in very short supply, but the supply is increased. And it's allocated on a state-by-state basis by the federal government. Washington is getting some. It is spreading it around the state. So some of the pharmacies on the Olympic Peninsula have had small supplies from time to time. And we expect that to get better and better. You don't get it directly through the pharmacies. It's a prescription drug. It has to be prescribed by a licensed practitioner given under their supervision. And that these are powerful drugs, and they interact with a number of other medications. So they have to be given carefully. Sometimes you have to stop other medications in order to give them. But this is going to be a crucial strategy in the months and years ahead as we get more and more of these antiviral medications. And it's going to be challenging to use them because you have to use them very early in the course of the disease, really in the first 5 days of infection, and the sooner the better. So it means we need to identify people who are at risk of complications, and we need to test them rapidly and then initiate treatment. But if we do those things right, drugs like Paxlovid can reduce risk of serious disease by as much as 90%. So that's a huge development and a very important tool in protecting the immunosuppressed. Unfortunately, the licensure for them stops at age 12. So they're not available for children. They're not available for the under 5 year age group as of yet, at least. And right now in Washington State, we're prioritizing them for sort of the people who are most at risk of complications. And then, and I just add that they will be available through local pharmacies. They're, part of the question was, will we have to travel to distant pharmacies? And the answer is hopefully no. The plan is to get them distributed throughout the state and to have them available locally, because as I said, you have to start them quickly in order for them to be effective. And then the final question is about swimming pools. And the KPTZ listener just says they're in a large building with a heated pool and kind of asking about COVID risk. Fortunately, we now have good evidence that risk of transmission in swimming pool areas is really low. And it probably has to do with, number one, the humidity. The more humid it is, the more that that humidity kind of combines with airborne virus particles, makes them heavier and causes them to drop out of the air. And then the disinfectants that are used in swimming pools, chlorination or ozonation, these are also very effective antiviral disinfectants. And so those two factors make swimming pools a very safe place. Now, changing rooms or other areas of the facility, those can involve risk, although the listener seems to be well aware of that. So their policy is to use masking and close quarters. So basically, they're doing a good job. People don't need to wear masks in swimming pools. Probably isn't even safe to do that because you can't really breathe through a wet mask. But as with any other indoor space, you have to be conscious of the risk. So I think that's it for KPTZ questions and some time to spare for Willie.
Willie, it's nice to see you. We've missed you the last couple of weeks, so it's great to see you.
Little bit of a break. It's good to be back. So thanks for having me. And Dr. Locke must be a little bit rusty giving me 9 whole minutes rather than the usual 3 or 4. So thank you. I appreciate that. And welcome back, Dr. Locke. We had on Saturday what we believe might be our last mass vaccination clinic at Chimicum, our favorite spot. Just 2 short hours, but we managed to get 70 folks through, about a dozen of whom were walk-ins, which we always like to see those folks take advantage of the opportunity. And it was an interesting mix of folks coming in, first, second, third, even a fourth dose, I believe. And we had all ages. You know, we had the young kids all the way to the older adults. So it was a good variety of folks coming out for what we believe might be our final event. Given the decrease in demand, although again, we did see a pretty decent turnout there, and the availability at our local pharmacies through the healthcare sector, et cetera. So it's been just a little bit shy of a calendar year. We started in early March of 2021, so we didn't quite hit the year mark. But again, given the decrease in demand and the increase of availability, we believe this might be our last big clinic, at least for the foreseeable future. We are going to maintain a readiness and an availability should we need to spring this capability back up in relatively quick order. But we currently have no more mass vaccination clinics on the calendar. So if you are looking for a vaccine or a booster dose, information remains available on the public health website. We will have our call center still available as a resource for folks. 344-9791. Although calls to that resource have dropped off precipitously over the past couple of months. That is a really valuable resource for folks who might be homebound or have limited mobility, who can't travel to a pharmacy to get a booster dose or the like. So you can still call into that line, and we will continue to maintain a list. And when we have a couple of folks in relatively close by to one another, we still will have a team to be able to make a home visit to those folks. You can also call that line if you are unsure of where to go. There are lots of resources online on how to find a vaccine or booster dose, but we're gonna maintain that at least for the next couple of weeks to help answer questions. Public Health and us, we will be looking to support some outreach to the homeless community as well to try to get some more of those folks vaccinated and or boosted. But yeah, at this point in time, as we move towards the endemic phase and out of the pandemic phase, no more of those large events on the calendar for us. So huge thanks to Public Health, all of our volunteers, many of whom have been at these events weekend in and weekend out. So much appreciation there. Commissioner Brotherton had addressed something I was hoping to bring up, and that's around KN95 and N95 masks and their ability to protect the wearer as opposed to cloth masks, which by catching those air droplets are more intended to protect others. We continue to make those available through the state stockpile that they've released to the general public. So we had been pushing those out as fast as we can. We think we've been finally able to get the supply to meet the demand. They are available at local grocery stores, at the libraries, through the food banks. We've been supplying the chamber to hand out to other local small businesses. One piece of feedback we got was that there is a federal mask distribution program intended for pharmacies. So they're only distributing those N95s from the federal government to major chain pharmacies, of which we have none here in Jefferson County other than the grocery stores. So we've made those masks available to Tri-Area, to the pharmacy in Port Ludlow, et cetera. So we'll continue to find some new avenues to distribute those as well. A huge thank to our neighborhood preparedness volunteers who had a distribution event in Port Townsend and one in Port Ludlow. And we were able to push out about 5,000 masks through those points of distribution to our organized neighborhoods. This week, we'll look at, we'll be in touch with our city and county departments to be able to supply folks coming in to utilize government services. We'll have a KN95 or an N95 for you here relatively soon. And again, we'll continue to push those as long as there's a demand. Again, those are really important because those do still protect others, but they'll provide you a little bit of protection as well. And I know that's a big concern for folks as we have the end to the masking mandate on the horizon. Other than that, that is it from me, barring any questions.
Any questions for Willie, Greg, Kate?
I have one, just a little clarification if you can, Willie. If someone's looking to pick up one of these distributed KN95s or KF94s, they would go to a grocery store and just ask for them, or?
Yeah. Go into one of the grocery stores. The Department of Public Health has them as well. We have a list of all the locations on the website. So you can check there or call us at DEM. We've had a few folks who've been kind of confused by the whole process. We're trying to make them as available in as many places as possible. But feel free to give us a ring and we can point you in the right direction as well.
Thanks for that.
Thanks, Willie. It was great to see you today, Dr. Locke. Thanks for filling in for Dr. Berry this week. And great to have you back, Willie. So with that, I think we will move on to our next item, which is, I think, looking forward on our calendar.